Why should Jesus get all the good music?
I don't think you've listened to enough Stephen Curtis Chapman to make well, not, that sort of
not
assertion.
All the good music, yeah. Granted. What was that documentary called?
Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Music?
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Which was a documentary about
Christian speed metal.
Christian rock. No, not Christian speed metal. It was a documentary about Christian rock and this big music festival. And,
but it was not just like rock. I mean, there was...
No. They had, they had like Pedro the Lion in there too, which was not, I mean, they were Christians when that band was together, but they weren't a Christian band. And now, lead dude, David Bazan, he's like an atheist now. Like, he's totally left.
I seem to recall, like, they talk to some little 4-year-old girl and they're like, imitate daddy.
Well, yeah.
And she goes, bah, 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 bah.
No, what happened was there was a Christian death metal band in the movie, and I can't remember now what the name of the band was, but the guy had a daughter, and the mom says, be daddy. Playing music in the little, she's like 3 or 4. And she goes, Jesus. It was pretty funny. And the, I can't, and like the Danielson family were in the movie.
Right.
And they're really cool and weird. I don't know. I don't think they're a band anymore. I think they all went off their separate ways. They all just went out and got jobs, I guess.
Maybe they became actual nurses. They already had the uniform.
They were fantastic. The Danielson family were so great. I don't think they ever got their due because they were just so weird.
Yeah.
They were just so super crazy.
Should we
weird.
Close the sliding?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah. Why don't you do that?
You talk about the Danielson
family. I'm busy. If you don't know who they were... They were a family band in the 90s that made really weird music. And when they performed live, they would all dress up like doctors and nurses. And the lead guy would sometimes come out on stage like in a Christmas tree costume.
as you do.
And they were, they were Christians. Like all their songs were about God. Mm-hmm. All their songs were about God. And but they were such weird songs. I don't think actual Christians ever wanted to listen to them.
I don't think the Free Design ever really got embraced by a whole lot of Christians.
Like the Danielson family would go on tour with cool bands. They didn't go on tour with, you know, like I said, Stephen Curtis Chapman.
Yes.
Who, and that's it's just that Stephen Curtis Chapman is on my mind because
a song of his was
song
at your
his
niece's wedding, right?
At my niece's wedding. And I just like when I heard that
another one of your churchy friends' weddings that you took me to, they did a Reliant K song.
Where was this?
At Bob's wedding.
Was that a Reliant K song?
Yeah, that musical number that erupted in the middle of everything. That was a Reliant K song.
Oh, I didn't know what that was when that happened.
Yeah, I Googled it later.
That was fun though. When
it
that
was
happened.
Lovely. It
yeah,
was, it was before the YouTube thing where, like, you know, suddenly white people in a wedding party were all bursting into song and dancing around. It was pretty great.
That was pretty good though.
We just made everybody sing Burt Bacharach.
Right. The I'm sorry. My microphone is all.
Well, you pivoted it.
I know, but now it's loose.
Yeah. Well, you got to pivot it back.
I just fixed it. Yeah, there was a boring Stephen Curtis Chapman song that was played at my niece's wedding. That's redundant because all Stephen Curtis Chapman songs are boring. If you don't know who Stephen Curtis Chapman is, yeah. It doesn't matter. Like, he's got plenty of fame and fortune already from what he does. And if you like him, then it's because you like that kind of
thing. There is interesting Christian music out there. His is not among us. And I don't mean that it's not Christian.
Are we just only talking about this because of the song I just
played?
Yes, because
you're playing gospel.
It's a gospel song by Gloria Spencer called
I Got It. Wait, we've been talking about
gospel. We were talking about gospel music this morning because of Bernie, which opened a few weeks ago.
Did I talk about it at all? We mentioned it last week, and then you were like, "Well, you wanted me to see it, so I went and saw it."
So you went to see it, and then you were giving me HE double hockey sticks about
giving you Spilkis
playing like screamy black gospel music,
which don't get me wrong, is terrific, but it's not the kind of music they listen to in Bernie.
There's a lot of gospel.
It's very white.
In Bernie, it's white Southern gospel.
Yeah.
And hymns and stuff like that.
Love lifted me, kind of thing.
I came home from that screening the first time, and I was like, I knew every song.
Of course you did.
Yeah. From my childhood.
Your backwards childhood.
My backwards childhood. There were some good things about the church.
I should mention, are Dave White of Movies.com.
Yes, I am.
And Slake Magazine.
That is correct. Slake Magazine, which has there's a new issue.
On sale now.
Of Slake, S-L-A-K-E, a literary / journalism / fiction.
Well, I think a literary magazine can encompass
thing. It's
non-fiction.
All the things. It's all kinds of writing.
I will post
it's a like
link.
A big thick book.
Yeah,
you can buy it
on Amazon. I will post a link on our Linoleum Knife page on Facebook. And please use that link because we get a little kickback. And
we do.
This is a free show. We could use the little,
Slake is a fancy magazine here in LA. You can get it anywhere online. But it's all about Los Angeles and Los Angeles writers. Telling stories about Los Angeles, and I'm one of them. I've contributed to 2.5 issues of the 4 that have come out. There was one that I was too late. Well, no.
Yeah, the magazine was
the
too
magazine
late.
Was too late. They went to print after
December.
December.
And you'd written a Christmas
story. I had written a Christmas story. And
is that still online? Can people still find it?
Maybe.
Well, if we can find a link, we'll put that up too.
But I have a new story in this issue. I'm very proud of it. And I read Ed Story's books in Echo Park the other night. And I was great.
I will take your word for it.
I was great.
I had to go to a screening of The Dictator that night, which we'll talk about next week.
I've been real proud of myself the past few days.
Have.
I'm really good at reading aloud.
Your own work.
I'm a great reader alouder of my own work.
Yes.
Yeah, don't ask me to read aloud your own, your copy for
your narration.
For your voiceover job that you want me to do. Somebody made the mistake recently of paying me money to do a voiceover gig, and I think I ruined it. Like, he said that I did a great job.
I'm sure they could put something in the edit bay that would work.
Because
whenever we would talk, when people would say, "Oh, you should do voiceover," right. You're always like, "I'm not an actor." I didn't really quite appreciate the depth of that until I watched you do this voiceover. You can't take direction at all.
No, I don't know what I don't know what to do.
You have no idea.
What
they're telling you to do and how to change things.
It's like someone trying to explain calculus to me. Mm. It's hard. Unless you have a natural talent for doing that kind of thing, you don't have a talent for doing that kind of thing. it's really tough to be given material and then told, just be natural, just do your thing. And I'm like, well, my thing would be to never say anything like this. Like, my thing would be to never say the copy that I was given to read, I told him that as I was doing it. You were sitting right here helping me record it for him, but I was so stupid about what kind of direction. I mean, he was giving me good direction, and I could tell I was not hearing him properly. Because he would say, okay, now do it like this. And I'd be like, oh, God, I'm ruining everything. And
it was kind of like that scene in Radio Days where Mia Farrow is singing the Get Regular with Relax, you know, and they kept, like, giving her all these really specific notes about, you know, like, it's a laxative. Make it brighter, you know.
Right. Yeah, I was terrible. But my own...
But reading your own stuff?
I was happy to do it. I was happy to get paid, and I was happy for the confidence that he had in me, which has now been shattered.
Which was thoroughly misplaced, but, it turns out.
But now, what I know is that I sound great when I'm reading my work in front of an audience. I sound awesome when I'm doing my stuff on KCRW.
Yes, on Unfictional.
On Unfictional, which is a show I'm on. And you go to kcrw.org and you'll hear, you just click on shows and I'm in five or six of them.
Yep. CNN this week.
What does that have to do with me?
Because it's enough of you already. Time for it's a little me time.
What were you doing on Saturday, Alonzo?
I was on CNN because...
Why were you on CNN, Alonzo?
Because Gray Drake was out of town and Matt Atchity had something else to do.
So you were third choice.
Basically, yes. Yeah. But I'll take it. You know, it worked. It was fine. No, it was fun. I got to go on and do a very... what felt like while it was happening, it felt like it was over before it started. But it was about
a five-minute
segment, maybe.
You weren't even on for 5 minutes.
Yeah, 3 minute segment,
maybe
perhaps,
three. Yeah,
with the weekend anchor, and we talked about box office, and we talked about the two of the movies we're going to talk about on the show this week, Dark Shadows and Bernie, and and I sat in this tiny, cramped little room in the LA bureau with this TV screen behind me showing, like, you know, the city lights and, you know, a searchlight thing, and it's that whole sort of, like, shorthand for Hollywood, you know.
Boring.
I'm sorry. Was I boring you?
No. I mean that whole aesthetic. The screen, whole aesthetic is boring to me.
They should have had, there should be an endless loop.
You're never boring.
There should be an endless loop behind the person of, like, a homeless guy urinating to one of the stars on Hollywood Boulevard or something. Yes. Really get that ambience.
You might be boring to our listeners, but you're never boring to me.
Well, thank you, Dave White. Yeah. So that was fun. And you had a very fancy Dan kind of movie night last night.
Oh, I was just going to say fancy Dan kind of day, which is what I had because I went to an art gallery.
That's true.
And then it was the last day of the Elizabeth Payton show. And if you don't know who she is, then you're not fancy like I am, I guess.
I guess I'm not.
And
I've heard you mention her, but I don't know anything.
She's the one that paints the portraits of celebrities. See? You see what I'm saying? You're just shaking. You're giving me a blank face.
I have no idea what you're
doing. You're not fancy like I am.
I'm not fancy like you
are. Then last night...
I don't hold my pinky out at art galleries.
Well, I will get it. Someone needs to follow me around with a camera.
Is that how you indicate the art? Look, everyone, pinky out.
I'm holding a cup of... I'm holding a little glass of champagne. A little tiny glass. A little miniature glass of champagne, right, because that's more delicate.
Like a dollhouse size.
And dainty, yeah. And I've got my pinky out. Like the guy in
Jamie Kennedy in Tyler Perry's Good Deeds.
He was pinky indicating because he was a gay character, you see.
We needed to know that.
We need to know how gay he was by his pinky pointing out. Well, that's what I do too. When I'm in a fancy environment, I like to make sure that everyone knows what a gay I am by holding a little glass of champagne and pointing with my pinky and saying things like, "It's exquisite." That's what I say. And I say it just like that so that people know.
That gentleman is of the gay persuasion.
Listen to that gay over there talking about how exquisite something is. That's what I do.
We should buy that art. I hear the gay says it's exquisite.
I'm the art whisperer. I just walk around. I look for people that look super rich who can afford things I can't. And I go, his career is really heating up. And I pointed it with my pinky. And they go, ooh, a gay said it.
Speaking of Tyler Perry, I was putting together my list of movies that I'm going to review for therap.com. Did you ever introduce me, by the way?
What?
Did you ever introduce me?
Alonzo Duralding of therap.com and some other thing. what the something flick. Who cares? me.
You're the worst.
Me.
Anyway, I was putting my list together for what I'm reviewing for therap.com in June. Tyler Perry's Media's Witness God, Protection. I can't wait. I may be more excited about that than about The Dark Knight Rises.
You of all people need to take that back right now. That's for me to say. You love the Batman.
I know, but it's weird. Like those have become so mainstream that they don't even feel like they're comic book movies anymore. They just feel like, oh, everybody wants to see the new Batman movie.
Uh-huh.
You know.
True. But everybody also wants to see the new Madea movie.
So go on with your day of fanciness. What else?
Well, now you got me all excited about Madea's Witness Protection.
We got a Hop Tracks on this show.
Double feature with Larry the Cable Guy's Witless Protection.
Did you see what I did there? And you could show it with Did You Hear About the Morgans?
Did You Hear About the Morgans?
And what's that movie where Tim Allen and Kirstie Alley have to go live with the Amish?
Oh, what is that called? What's that movie called?
Look it up.
I'm looking up something else. I'm looking up the Bresson stuff. I gotta see if it's on DVD, because the things I saw last night are also my DVD picks. Okay. If they're available.
Well, you should have done that before the show. So look up on IMDb. What is the Tim Allen? Because somebody is yelling it at their computer right now. Because of course somebody out there remembers.
Someone remembers
what that stupid movie is called.
Amish Mamish. Right? That's the name of it. My computer's being real slow. Now that you want me to get something for you, IMDb is being incredibly
slow. Well, they were going to call it just Witness, but there was already a movie about Amish people and Witness Protection called that, so they couldn't use it.
Kirstie.
Anyway, while Dave was being all fancy and going to see Robert Bresson movies at the Arrow last night,
which he'll be
telling you about momentarily, I went to Cinefamily, which I don't get to nearly often enough, even though I have a membership.
We talk about it all the time.
I know, they're great, but it's just, you know, there's so much of their cool stuff.
We end up going about once a month.
Happens on weeknights when we've got like work screening stuff. So I went and did two back-to-back movies last night. Spirited Away. They're doing the Ghibli retrospective right now. And, oh my God, I love that movie so much. And I hadn't seen it in about 5 or 6 years or something. So I had forgotten little details. Like, I had forgotten about the big baby getting turned into the fat rat and stuff, you know. And it is, and I'd never really, I mean, I guess to some level I'd thought about it, but never really consciously. But the guy introducing it talked about how there's a real sort of dream logic to it.
Right.
And when you look at it that way, it that's totally how the plot works. I mean, just the way that the things that people have to do and the way the way the landscapes are built, and like when you're on staircases, they just seem to go on forever. And just there's so many things about it that does feel like you are just having this dream. And it is, you know, probably one of my 10 favorite movies of all time. I really think it's just exquisite. And
for richer or poorer?
No.
Yeah. A real estate hustler and his wife hide from the IRS.
Oh, that is it. Okay.
Among the Amish. Was that what it was called?
For Richer or Poorer? I guess so. I don't remember it being called
that. It seems like they changed the title.
I thought it was something shorter and punchier.
Yeah, I think it was, actually. I can't remember it being called that. Of course, I didn't go see it either. But
there was another Kirstie Alley movie around that time that seemed like it was going to be funny, and then it wasn't, where
named every Kirstie Alley movie that
ever's
been.
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah.
Where she like has sex with some guy and then he dies, and then it turns out that he's like, he was her in-law that she'd never met or something crazy like that. It was called like Sibling Rivalry or something like that. I don't remember.
Sibling Bonery.
So what Bresson movies did you go to last night, Fancy Dan?
I saw Pickpocket.
Oh, nice.
Which is, you know, real famous.
Uh-huh.
That is a classic of world cinema.
Of neorealism, would you call it? Does it fall in that category?
What do we call it then? I don't know.
Oh, not so fancy.
You could put me on the spot. The neorealism. And then I saw L'Argent. Hmm. L'Argent,
his last film?
Yes, from 1983. Pickpocket is from 1959.
It's so cool when, like, when you look at like the late 70s, early 80s. I mean, they weren't all necessarily good movies, but you had like these last films from people who had been doing it like since the day, you know.
Right.
You got like Billy Wilder's Fedora and George Cukor's Rich and Famous, and
right.
you know, just the sort of like the kind of the last gasp of a lot of these folks, you know. Of course, this is also the period where like. This bugs me to this day that, like, Steven Spielberg spent I don't know how much money to buy the existing copy of Rosebud, the sled from Citizen Kane.
Right.
But could not arrange to give, like, Orson Welles $1 million to finish, you know, The Other Side of the Wind.
Or whatever. Of course.
You know, right. that just drives me up the wall. I mean, he and Coppola, I think, came to... Kurosawa's rescue. I think they like helped him finish Kagamusha and stuff.
Right.
But a lot of the American directors who were still around from, you know, who had been so influential in that period could not get arrested, you know.
Well, that was Bresson's problem in his life. His career spanned like 5 decades, and he made 13 movies in that time.
Wow.
He had, well, you know, and there's a reason. For this,
what was his day job?
I think that was his day job. He was so uncompromising about what he did, and so
and a thing but compromising right on Bresson. Sorry,
he was so it was not you didn't. I don't think anyone told him anything.
Right.
Like
he didn't get notes.
Yeah, I don't think anybody who gave Bresson money had any say so or anything. No, and I mean, if they did, if they gave him money, I think it was always on the stipulation that you stay away,
right?
And I will do exactly as I please, and that was a good thing because him doing exactly as he pleased meant that he made 13 movies that were all.
Exactly his vision.
Basically perfect. You know, like he doesn't, and they're not super long movies either. Pickpocket is 75 minutes long. Hmm. L'Argent was 85 minutes long. But by the end of that 75 and by the end of that 85, you're tired because your attention span abilities have been through boot camp. Like you are.
Is he like long takey? Or?
Nope. Everything on screen is there exactly the way he wants it to be. It is. There's nothing wasted. He makes economical movies that are highly concentrated, full of his thing. And his thing is just this Spartan, raw, minimal sort of, you know, action going on at you, and you've got to really, really watch and really, really think about where he's going and what he's doing and why. He was really Catholic, and so all of his films have to do with, you know,
guilt,
redemption, and salvation, and the, you know, punishment, and then also like grace, but often the people just wind up going down the stoniest of ends. Like there is nobody, like I just invited someone to see a movie a Thursday night. I'm going back. Mm-hmm. Now these are my, L'Argent and Pickpocket are both on DVD. L'Argent is out of print, but you can find it. You can buy it, you know, and I recommend if you're a person who buys DVDs, you know, you should own these DVDs because this is like, this is not just going to the movies and being entertained. This is having like life-changing stuff slap you in the face when you watch it. I could watch this guy's movies over and over and over because every time you will watch his movie, you will see and understand something new about yourself or about the world or about cinema. Like he's one of those guys that was all about pure cinema. Like he wanted theatrical language to be different from cinematic language. So, you know, like theatrical language is all about the actor's performance. But with Bresson, he didn't want the actors to perform at all. So he would use non-actors and then he would make them do take after take after take after take to rid them of their performance. And so people get upset now who don't know where he's coming from. Mm-hmm. And they watch his movies and the people are all like, go to the bank and rob the bank. I just robbed a bank and I just killed everyone. Like, and I mean, it's in French, but that's how they're saying the lines. It's well, that's absolutely stripped of emotions like that, and any sort of affectation, nothing. And so
that's like the famous Billy Wilder story where he's working with Jack Lemmon and they do a take and Billy's like, oh, that's great. It's just a little less, just, you know, down a little less. And they do another take and he did less. Great. A little less. And they do like three or four or five takes, you know, where and finally Jack Lemmon gets frustrated and said, if I do any less, I'm not going to be acting at all. And Wilder says, yes, please.
Well, that's what a Pishat-Bong Weir Sethakul does, too.
And Kubrick. A lot He's of like, people, yeah. Fincher, apparently.
Take it down to nothing.
Yeah.
Always take it down. And that's what he did. And so if you want to be real fancy about it, you get what the theoretical people are always calling pure cinema from Bresson. And so it's an experience, and you will not forget it, and you will be exhausted when it's over.
Well, I kind of wish you had come to. I mean, I'm sure it was great. I'm sure you had a blast. I kind of
wish you had come. You wish I had come to the rollerblading.
No, I'm going to get to that later. Okay, I wish you had come to Spirited Away.
I've seen Spirited Away.
I know, but it just reminded me because like so much of media that is either about or aimed at young girls has gotten so icky.
Yes.
You know, that whole Central Wilson thing about the proliferation of Disney princesses and right. whatnot, you know. It was just so great to see this movie that is about a young girl who basically has to stop being such a brat and, like, call on her inner resources and, you know, help out people and, you know, help herself. I wish I could...
Someone's calling.
How about you turn your phone off?
All right. Who do we know with a 310?
Lots of people. Turn your phone off.
Let me make it... Okay.
I'm going to kick you out of the movie theater.
Reject. There, we're done. I'm turning off the phone.
Shh, rude.
So we...
Like, yeah, I'm going to... Not like that guy in God Bless America, I'd be shooting you. We'll be talking about that.
Look, I'd have gotten shot anyway. Because I do all the sorts of wrong things. Because
you say the word stoked.
I say stoked too much.
Oh, let's talk about God Bless America.
Yeah, why not? We're done talking. My DVD pick, L'Argent and...
Pickpocket.
Yeah, Pickpocket.
Now, look into
Robert Bresson, B-R-E-S-S-O-N.
Pickpocket's out of print. See if it's on... Or L'Argent's out of print.
But the first Bresson movie you need to watch before you watch any of them is Balthazar.
Oh, Hazard Balthazar.
That's the one.
Look on Netflix real quick. And
what about it?
See if they're available.
Oh, is it on Netflix?
Yeah, I'm asking. Because somebody... one of our friends in San Diego complained on Twitter that Danger Diabolic is apparently out of print and not on Netflix.
It's not?
Nope.
How's it out of print?
I don't know. Stupid Paramount. Anyway, so yeah, God Bless America is the fourth feature film. From former stand-up comedian Bobcat Goldthwait. And,
does he not do stand-up at all anymore?
I don't think so. I think he's just a filmmaker now. And, I mean, he might act, I don't know. Right. And it's been available, I think it's still available on demand and is opened theatrically this weekend. And it is a satire, starring Joel Murray,
brother. L'Argent is, it's on Netflix and it says availability, DVD availability date unknown.
Oh, brother.
I don't know what that means.
Rots a ruck, in other words.
Yeah.
Stars.
There's lots of other. Balthazar is on Netflix.
Okay,
and so is Pickpocket.
Okay,
yeah.
Anyway, God Bless America stars Joel Murray, who is the brother of Bill, as a guy who is divorced and just got fired and just got diagnosed with a brain tumor, and so he decides that he's going to lash out at moron culture, basically, specifically reality TV stars, and after he kills a petulant, horrible young girl from a My Super Sweet 16 type show, he garners himself a young female sidekick who agrees with him about society's vermin that need to be taken out.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And then they run around killing everybody.
And they run around killing a bunch of people. And it's
and talking about the things they hate.
Yes. At length.
You know what movie is great? Where people run around talking about things they hate? Ghost World.
Yes.
And do you know what happens to those people in Ghost World? One of the things that they all learn is that they are part of
the problem.
The problem. And they are part of the world. They are part of the same world of the things they hate. And they have to sort of reckon with that. And not so much that they learn lessons, but that
life... Or that the things they hate aren't worth hating.
Life moves on without them if they stay stuck in their anger. Or that the things they hate aren't fully, totally worth hating in the first place. So that's why Ghost World is such an amazing movie and hilariously funny.
God Bless America, on the other hand, is neither of these things.
Right.
Even if you agree, as I do, with a lot of the things that Goldthwait has to say about, you know...
I'm sorry, Mr. Goldthwait, that I say stoked. I realize that I am the problem. I realize that it's a problem. I shouldn't say it. I say it almost as much as I say awesome, which is way, way too much. I also say like way too much, and I apologize for that as well. I also apologize for, what else is it that I do that's wrong, according to...
You high five.
I high five people. I don't initiate the high five, but
you will complete a high five.
I'll complete it. If you high five me, I'm not going to leave you hanging. My only sin of actual commission that he thinks I should be shot for is that I watched Reality Household Wives.
The Household Wives of New Jersey.
The Household Wives of New Jersey. Specifically New Jersey.
Yes.
Because they're violent. They're the only ones that are violent. All the other housewives, they just sit around and go, meh, 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 to each other. But the New Jersey housewives, they will fight. They will have real, actual fights.
Right.
And hurt each other. And that's hilarious. And so I want to watch wrestling, and I want to watch Housewives do it.
But this movie is so, like, preachily, like...
And I'm not sorry, either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God Bless America is so preachy and so haranguey about its point. Like, it even... Like, there's a whole segment where they go... Where they pick apart Diablo Cody. And I don't particularly...
Why?
I don't particularly like Diablo Cody.
I think she's fine.
I felt defensive towards and about her by the time they were done. I was like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
But again, she's part of the... One of the problems with this film is that it feels like it's sat on the shelf for a while because their big targets, apart from Ms. Cody, seem to be like My Super Sweet 16 and William Hung.
American Idol, specifically William
Specifically
Hung.
American Idol, but specifically William Hung. And it's like, really? Like, yeah. I had to kind of remember that guy's name, you know?
Well, it has this, they did shoot this a while back because as we watched it.
Yeah, there are locations that are no longer in existence.
It's not set. Fully in Los Angeles, but
yeah, but they as like a lot of low budget movies do, they'll shoot something in LA and pass it off as somewhere else.
Right.
And there's like a movie theater they shoot in front of that is well, one that's now boarded up, and the other one that's not really a movie theater anymore.
Right, it's not in use.
No, but you know what? If you were shooting that movie tomorrow, you could still get that interior.
The point is that these are places that are no longer functioning locations. In the city where they shot the film. And they have not been functioning locations
for some time,
a few years. So this movie was clearly shot in like 2008 or 2007 or something. Like, it was shot a long time ago. And if you're going to do a media satire? And you only know that if you live here. And because we live here, we saw that these locations that they used are not around really anymore. And so...
Even if you don't live here, though, you'll smell something.
Yeah, well,
old.
This is you'll know that these references that they're making, the things that the movie is angry about, the specific cultural things that the movie is pissed off about, they are out of date.
They're dated.
They've been satirized and mocked and run through the ringer by every other comedian and cultural commentator out there, and so. The fact that we know that these locations have been gone for a while
also underscores
the fact that, yeah, this was shot a while ago.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that if you're going to make a satire that's topical, It should be as quick as you can make it.
Yeah, the subjects still need to be topical by the time your movie hits theaters.
I mean, you can extrapolate to the larger, you know, world of reality, this and, you know, Shallow that. But
if you're going to have specific targets.
Yeah, you're going to have specific targets, then they have to not be things that, you know.
It's like telling Watergate jokes in 1981.
Exactly. It would be the equivalent of someone making Monica Lewinsky jokes. You know?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And so that is a big problem in this movie. The dark humor is trite and tired, and it's been over joked about at this point.
What's also a problem is that, like, when you have material like this, I mean, like, even a movie like Idiocracy, which I think it mostly works, even though the collective effect of it is depressing when you really think about what the movie is saying and how true a lot of it is. You know, this kind of satire, you have to sort of weave into a story where we discover it in ways that isn't just someone looking at the camera and telling you all about the thing.
How wrong it is.
Yeah. And there's a good 3 or 4 times in this movie where Joel Murray basically is with one other person and sits there and tells them all the things about what culture that is wrong and why do we do this and blah, 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 blah. It's like, okay, show me, don't tell me. You know, like this is...
There are several lectures, actual real lectures in the movie, where the guy is just telling you everything that he hates and what's wrong with the world and why we're all going to hell.
Yeah.
I don't care. I really don't care. I want you to present these things to me in a cinematic way.
Yes.
Not just with some guy yelling at me.
Yeah.
I might as well go to church. Well, if that's,
you know, or write an op-ed piece, you know, if that's what you have, if that's what you're going to do. But if you're going to make it a movie, it has to exist in a... So it has to function in some sort of dramatic way that it's not just this harangue.
Now, a person on the internet who disagrees with me said to me that the film is not a comedy.
I don't think that's true.
And I thought about that for a while and thought, well, okay, maybe it is not meant to be a dark comedy. Maybe it's meant to be just what it is. And even if that is the case,
it's still bad drama if there's that much speechifying in
it. Even if that is the case, it's bad drama. And the movie goes after targets that are, we've been talking about how dated they are. They're still, even if they were current, even if they were going after right now, let's say this movie was made yesterday and it somehow magically wound up in theaters today and they were yelling about the Kardashians or, who else is a jerk recently? You know, if you're
Charlie Sheen.
Yeah. Wrong targets. Because those people are just employed by the machine. They're just employees. They aren't the people who greenlit those programs on television. So keeping up with the Kardashians, don't go after Kim Kardashian. Go after Ryan Seacrest.
Yes.
And furthermore, don't go after Ryan Seacrest. Go after NBC Universal, because now don't they run E! Now?
They do, yes.
Yeah. And don't and here I am. I'm an employee of NBC Universal.
We work for them.
Yeah. And so, but what I'm not saying go after NBC Universal. They are my employer. What I am saying is
the movie sets its sights too low.
Aim for the people responsible.
It would have been this would have been a truly daring
things you don't like.
This would have been a truly daring satire if they had wanted to talk about the corporations that create all this garbage and give it to us 24/7 and the collusion between corporations and government to keep us occupied with mind-numbing spectacle so that we aren't paying attention to governance and to the corporatization of this country and to, you know, all the, these are basically the bread and circuses, you know, the Kardashians, all that stuff is bread and circuses. And it's like, this is what people talk about around the water cooler instead of talking about corporate tax breaks or, you know, transvaginal ultrasound abortion laws in Virginia or whatever.
Right.
You know, you try and talk about subjects like that in mixed company, and it's like, you know, they've managed to successfully polarize the conversation enough that you can't have those conversations in any kind of civil way. And so, you know, so we're left talking about the finalists on The Voice. You know, that movie would have been actually transgressive and actually making a serious point about the way we live today.
Right.
But instead, he takes the sort of facile way out and picks as his targets all the sort of, you know, the ones who were on the surface and not the ones who were pulling the strings. Now I'm ranting.
Go Cable Town. Who pays me money every month. What other movies are we talking about this week?
Dark Shadows. Dark Shadows is a movie that made me realize that I need to start wearing a watch again. Because I can't check the time on my phone, because, you know, turning on my phone in a theater would be awful.
Nice. And bad and wrong.
But, you know, a little Timex on my wrist where I just click the little button and it lights up for a second so I know how much more of my life I've wasted, you know. Because there's a new Ice Age and a new Madagascar movie coming up, so I need to be ready. Because Dark Shadows was just like, I'm so bored. I am so bored. Like, could something please happen that isn't the same thing that's already happened 8 times? It is a reboot of the vintage gothic soap opera from the late 60s and early 70s, which apparently Johnny Depp and Tim Burton were big fans of.
Right.
But you'd never know it from this movie because they basically throw it out the window and take the wacky route, which would be fine if this movie were remotely funny, which it's not. You know, Johnny Depp plays Barnabas Collins, who is cursed by a witch to be a vampire because he did not return her love, and she has him buried alive in the late 18th century. And then in 1972, his coffin is accidentally disinterred by a construction crew, and he returns to Collinsport and to discover that the same witch Angelique is still alive. She has ruined his family's fishing concern.
Eva
and
Green doing a weird American accent.
A series of weird American accents, unfortunately. And the only people still left living in the moldering mansion are I forget their names. Michelle Pfeiffer and Elizabeth Collins Stoddard and Roger Collins, played by Michelle Pfeiffer and Johnny Lee Miller, and their kids, played by Chloe Grace Moretz, and I forget who plays the boy. And blah, 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 blah. Nothing of much interest happens.
It's the Brady Bunch movie.
It's the Brady Bunch movie, but not
clever.
But not clever and not even that cohesive. Because, like, the movie, you know, after all the flashback stuff in colonial America, then we meet young Victoria Winters, you know, who is on her way to Collinsport to be the new nanny. And, you know, it's through her eyes that we meet this family and see what's going on. And she's the spitting image of Barnabas's lost love. And then she disappears for like two-thirds of the movie.
Yeah, there's no point.
They just toss her aside.
Well, the movie tosses characters aside whenever it feels like.
Oh, yeah. Willy-nilly.
At the end, you don't know what happened to anybody.
Yeah.
Except Barnabas and the ghost, the corpse bride.
Yeah, they truck off Johnny Lee Miller, like literally. Like, okay, bye.
He's gone.
You know, it looks good, you know. It's
it looks fantastic.
It's art directed really interestingly. They
didn't
get
say
to a fare thee well.
A fare thee well.
They get the period details very right, and I like the way how that all the clothing is either like super earth-tony or super garishly bright colored, and everyone's face is like sucked of color, like human, vampire, witch, doesn't matter. Everybody is just ghastly marble white.
Right.
But it's a bore.
Yeah, it really is. And it's sad because, you know, I want something more from the 70s than, woohoo, macrame and lava lamps and the Carpenters. Weren't they all terrible and tacky and funny and hilarious? I would like just once for any movie that wasn't Superstar
to talk about how awesome the Carpenters were.
To talk about how awesome the Carpenters were. And to, you know,
there's that awful The Broken Hearts Club, but that's about it.
Was there something about the Carpenters in that movie?
Yes.
Well, I don't remember.
The one black character in the film, incongruously, is a huge Karen Carpenter
fan. I thought it was a Celine Dion fan. Are you sure you're not mixing that up?
I'm positive.
I don't know.
I'm positive.
You think you're positive.
I think, in fact, there's a joke. I think what you're thinking of is that somebody, he's talking about Karen Carpenter, and somebody makes a joke about, like, you know, is she like Celine? He's like, you know, leave this house. You know, that sort of
thing. Are you sure?
That's how I remember it. I don't know.
I don't know about you. I have to. We think we got to go look that up.
You go look it up. I'm not watching that movie.
Well, I'm not going to watch the movie again. I saw the movie. It's terrible. But yeah, there's a lot of movies going on in this movie that never develop into anything, you know. And there's a lot of weird, like, subtextual things happening that I find uncomfortable making. You know, the whole idea of Barnabas Collins
Is an active vampire.
And well, like, that doesn't bother me. I don't care if he eats half the town.
But the thing is, the movie just doesn't... If they had addressed it one way or another, even if they had addressed it to the point of like, oh, well, this is happening, but we don't care. They just really don't ever kind of say anything about it. So like at the end of the movie when Angelique has riled up the townspeople and says, the Collins are harboring a murderer, you're like, well, actually, yes. Yes, they are, now that you mention it, you know.
But that's not the part I didn't like.
Okay, what were you going to say?
What I didn't like is... He uses Eva Green at the beginning of the movie to, hello, who wants to talk to Linoleum Knife? Call from Telefund. Talk. Off. He uses Eva Green at the beginning of the movie. He totally makes out with her.
Right.
Totally goes for it with her.
Mm-hmm.
And then casts her aside. And because he's the still alive heir to the Collins fortune,
mm-hmm.
he's essentially the Kennedy that gets to dump the other person.
The chambermaid or whatever.
Yeah, whoever, the help, essentially is what she is.
Right.
And it would be like on Downton Abbey if Lord Grantham had really hooked up with that maid.
Jane.
And then treated her cruelly. And cast her off, which is what he did
right.
for his true love, the fancy girl.
Josette.
Whatever. And so why shouldn't she, you know, stalk him with a vengeance for eternity? Why shouldn't she get hers? Mm. You know, what does she have when he dumps her at the beginning of the movie? Nothing. She's super poor. She's the maid's daughter or something. And she's got nothing. So why doesn't she go after him? She has every reason to go after him and bury him alive for 200 years. You messed with the wrong witch. So the thing is that that turns it into this whole thing of, well, you know, rich people should be able to do exactly as they please. And once they're done with you, you should just go off and be happy that you got to touch their golden garments for a while. And by the end of it, I was like, yeah. Yeah, destroy him and everything else. Eva Green, fine. You know, she built up her own fish stick factory to duel with him, and this is healthy competition. I was on her side.
The free market has decided.
Yeah, I was on her side, but she was the upstart, rebellious, you know, fish stick factory.
Well, we never even find out really how he manages to restore everything. Like, suddenly there's this montage that they're cleaning up the factory. And it's
well, he's got all the wealth in the basement.
Right? Oh, that's true, yeah. And he hypnotizes all the fishing boat captains. Yeah,
he hypnotizes people, and he's got tons of cash in the basement.
Anyway, this movie's a big snooze.
But it looks fantastic. There's so many great sets in this movie, and all of like the mechanical wolves and the thing that opens up
all
and
the trapdoors and
stuff. Yeah, the trapdoors and stuff. I love that kind of stuff.
Tim Burton,
it's good to look at. If you just want to go look at it, it's fine.
Tim Burton seriously needs an intervention or something.
But it's a terrible movie.
Because like he's just like, I was reading something online where they were saying that he needs to stop working with Richard Zanuck because Zanuck basically protects him from everybody.
Right.
And so nobody has any input and nobody can sort of say, this doesn't, you know. He's basically turned into George Lucas.
Right.
No one is saying no to Tim Burton.
Right.
And somebody needs to say no to Tim Burton because Tim Burton, left to his own devices, ain't good.
Unfortunately, I think what you have is a system where you have to become the kind of filmmaker like Scorsese who has in his contract, you know, stuff like Final Cut.
Right.
And like Tim Burton and like George Lucas, where no one is allowed to mess with you or else they'll just ruin it in a whole other way. You really, it's like needle in a haystack finding the collaborator with power who says no to you and is on board with what you want to do, but just wants to fine tune you to make sure that you stay right. on your game.
And that's what I'm saying.
Studios will just ruin you in this whole other direction.
I'm not saying that like somebody at Warner Brothers should have come in and told Tim Burton what to do, because that wouldn't have been any better.
Right.
But like, you know, to go back to the George Lucas example, you know, you look at like, I think Gary Kurtzman, I think is his name, who was the producer of like, of the original trilogy. And he was like the last guy who could be like, that's not a really good idea. And apparently also Lucas's first wife was very instrumental in being like, no. And of course he ditches both of them. Yeah. And so now he is unfettered. And this is, you know, what you get are the first three movies, right. the sequels. And so, yeah, I just wish there was somebody with taste and intelligence who Burton could trust enough to run things past.
Right.
Because, yeah, I just think that, I like Sweeney Todd, but I think, you know, he was dealing with really good source material there.
Right.
But beyond that, he has not made a good movie since...
I don't know.
Ed Wood? I mean, how far back are we talking?
Well, I like more of it than you do.
You like Mars Attacks, right?
I like Mars Attacks just fine.
Boo.
And I was okay with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Boo!
Up until the daddy, daddy, daddy stuff at the end. But again, the way stuff looks really takes me a long way. And so I'm on board for his aesthetic. You know, I like the Addams Family-ishness of it.
And the Johnny Depp as freaky outsider thing is really getting tired.
Right. I think that their collaboration, it can be more good than bad. I just want them to not lose themselves in we're having a blast. You know, clearly they're having a good time making these movies. Mm-hmm. But it would be nice if someone would come in and be like, you know, smacking him around a little bit.
I mean, like you look at Henry Selick, who got his big break, you know, directing Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yes.
And now he's made Coraline, which is
fantastic,
an extraordinary movie. And
such a great movie.
And I think it shows a real, you know, like you can see his evolution as an artist, you know.
Yeah.
And Burton isn't having that.
You're right.
Burton is evolving as an art director, but not as a director.
Yes.
Anyway, and getting back to the reason we started the show off with gospel music is Richard Linklater's Bernie, which opened wide this week and is, I think, one of the most successful limited release movies of the year so far.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Is it doing well?
It had its opening weekend, I think, was the most successful per screen average for a limited release.
I don't really pay attention to box office stuff.
I know. You're so cool.
I am, really.
But
I'm glad you reminded the audience that I am so cool.
Yes, that's because in radio, everyone can hear you make air quotes. It's based on a true story that was happening when we were living in Texas, and I had
but not paying any attention to it. Yeah, I didn't know what was going on. Sorry. It's Sunday afternoon. You know what we have to do? We have to stop doing this on Sunday afternoon.
You said you wanted to do it on Sunday afternoon.
I know, but I was mistaken. You have to tell me no.
Okay.
I'm Tim Burton. And you have to tell me no.
Fine.
We have to start doing this on Sunday morning when I'm alert.
When you're fresher.
Because this is my nap time.
Well, it's post pancakes. It's hard not to be in a coma.
A belly full of pancakes.
A plum reckon.
It's nap time because of pancakes. Sorry.
Anyway, so Bernie stars Jack Black in the title role as a funeral director in Carthage, Texas. And, he's great at his job. He knows how to, really knows how to prepare a corpse, as we see early on. He can sing just about anything at a funeral. He knows how to comfort the bereaved old lady widows. Never seems to have a date or anything with any women his own age, but everyone in town loves him. You know, he helps direct the musicals. He's just, you know, always there to lend a helping hand. And then Shirley MacLaine.
Because he's super gay.
Let's face it.
Yeah.
Shirley MacLaine plays Marjorie, who is an exceedingly cantankerous old...
Cantankerous is not the right word. She's mean, flat mean, out mean yeah, to everybody. Yeah.
She's a despicable old...
Marjorie Nugent.
Rich widow.
The and these are the real names.
These are the real people. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're really named these things.
And somehow the one person on Earth who can get close to her is Bernie. And they become good friends. They travel all over the world and, you know... and, you know, they hang out. And the more time they spend together, the more that she becomes reliant and dependent upon him, like fires everybody else who works for him.
Mean to him.
And exploit, yeah. I was going to say, and exploiting him at the same time and, like, constantly demanding his time and jealous of everything that he does when he's not around her and blah, blah, blah. So one day Bernie shoots her.
Until she's dead.
Until she's dead.
Yeah.
Without even realizing what he's doing.
Right.
But he does it.
He snaps in that. In that moment of sort of psychic break.
Yes, you know, and just bam.
Yeah.
So he...
And he confesses.
Well, and so then for a long time, no one sees her. And he says that she's had a stroke or that she's not feeling well or that she's in a nursing home in Temple. Like, she had already given him power of attorney. So he was able to sort of keep, you know, her house running and stuff, and was very generous with her money. Like, he didn't spend any of it on himself. Like, he had this same crappy house that he had, was paying the mortgage on, and this, you know, this shabby little Lincoln Continental. But, you know, he would buy playground equipment for people. He bought a couple of people jet skis or cars. He
sent
some kids to college, put a prayer wing on the church, all these things, you know, with Marjorie's money. And her accountant and her family start getting more and more suspicious of what's going on,
right.
And they finally find the body, and then there's a trial run by district attorney played by Matthew McConaughey, who I think should only play lawyers now.
Yeah,
that's, you know, that's
the Lincoln lawyer, and now this.
Yeah, he's found his niche.
I'm actually back to liking Matthew McConaughey.
I am. Yeah. It's amazing. Not since Paltrow have I gone so 180 on somebody that I was sick of. But the thing is, they have to move the trial somewhere else because everybody in Carthage loves Bernie.
Right.
And they think if he actually did do it, well, he must have had a reason because she was awful and he's so lovely.
And this is real because the film is cut through with real folks from Carthage, Texas, who are on camera just giving their own sort of like personal story about the real guy.
These are real people from the town. It's kind of like the witnesses in Reds.
Yeah.
But like they actually interact with the actors. I mean, to the point where it wasn't until the closing credits that I was entirely sure
who
were townspeople and who were actors because it's seamless. And, you know, and they're, you know, if you've ever lived in a small town and if you've ever lived in Texas, you totally...
Very specifically Texas.
You will recognize these people.
Yeah.
And there was one woman who I meant to remember her name and I've forgotten, D something, right, who talks about how, like, you know, how great Bernie was with the dead body and said, you know, if you had kind of an overbite, he could fix it so you weren't so sticky outy. And one of them is Matthew McConaughey's mother, who is... something else.
She's just exactly what you think she probably wanted.
Very, very like tan, gold chain wearing broad. I love this movie.
I love this movie too. And it's from the opening title card that said, the story you were fixing to see is true. Because let me tell you how tired I am of my so-called friends making fun of the way I talk. I can't go through a day without one of my friends mocking me for what I say, or somehow for the way I say something, you know. And it's, and I mean, I'm this is generic kind of stuff too. But when I am in Texas and when I lived in Texas, I don't sound like I'm from Texas. I sound like I'm neutral. Compared to the way people in Texas who've lived there their whole lives really talk, I sound like I'm a Tom Brokaw. Like when I leave Texas and I bring some of the regionalisms with me, you know, like how y'all doing, where we are, y'all going, I'm fixing to go to the store. Suddenly that is endlessly hilarious.
Well, it's mainly fixing to, because I say y'all and nobody bats an eye.
Yeah.
But fixin' to is that's a Texas thing.
That's I'm going to the store now. You know, like it's too easy. It's too hard to say going. It's easier to say I'm fixin' to. That's just it's easier to say it that way. And
you could say I'm gonna.
Whatever.
I'm not correcting you. I love when you say I'm fixing
my, to. My friends are constantly making fun of me. And so when that came up on the title card, I said, yes, see, real English. That is really part of the English language up there on that screen. What I love about this movie more than anything, just on top of the fact that I just found it super entertaining and funny and charming in its weird way.
Yeah.
I think Richard Linklater should only, just like Matthew McConaughey should only play lawyers from now on, Richard Linklater should only be making movies set in Texas.
And because mostly when, he has.
When he, yeah, but when he focuses on very distinct regional stuff,
mm-hmm.
I feel like he has an intuitive sense of the rhythm of life in Texas and the way people speak and the way they talk and the way they act and just everything about them. His movies breathe more easily when they are set in these environments. This is my favorite movie of his since Dazed and Confused. And I really love it when he stays put and does the stuff he knows how to do best.
I agree that he nails Texas in a way that certainly outsiders don't know
can't
how to do.
And never will.
And even among like the Texas filmmakers that are, I don't know, he is head and shoulders above. Like he's the best one for sure. I will say
I'm a Wes Anderson fan.
Well,
but Wes Anderson doesn't make films about Texas.
No, not since
Bottle Rocket.
You're right. But I'm saying as far as people who make films about Texas,
right.
However, I really liked Before Sunset.
It was fine.
Before Sunrise, not so much. Before Sunset, I really liked a lot. And so
it was okay.
I think that Linklater can leave Texas and it's, you know.
He can, but I like him best when
he
stays.
He is on home turf, he is definitely at his strongest.
I like him best when he stays put.
And Jack Black is so good.
If you hate Jack Black, you will like Jack Black in this movie.
Yeah, this is, he really...
This is Jim Carrey in I Love You, Philip Morris. This is,
yes.
This is like so weird and so not what he is.
Yeah, he channels all of his weirdness into these affectations that feel very honest.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the closing credits, you see Black meeting with the real Bernie.
And he looks like Jack Black.
Behind bars. it's amazing. And you brought up the other movie that I saw last night.
That's right, I did. I brung it up.
You brung it up. Was the 1993 rollerblading epic Airborne, which was one of Jack Black's first films. And
why don't you tell us about it?
Oh God, it's this movie about this like surfer bra, and they actually use the word bra without irony. Who gets transplanted to Cincinnati, Ohio? What a bummer, dude. But then it turns out that he's an awesome rollerblader, and then everybody likes him. It's a dumb movie. Dumb movie. But Jack Black, young Jack Black in it, doesn't get much to do and isn't particularly funny. But it was just weird, because I saw Bernie on Friday, and I saw Airborne on Saturday. And it was sort of like, you know, I think the only movie that he had made before that one, I think he plays one of the rich kids that appears briefly in Bob Roberts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But anyway, so it was just odd to see the spectrum of his work. But yeah, he is extraordinary in Bernie. It's really, he plays a recognizable type, but he also plays a recognizable human being.
Man, how many of these guys did I know in Texas?
School teachers?
School. Well, a few, yeah. You know, feminine guys who were just really, 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 really nice.
Clay
and really Aiken-y. Helpful, real Clay Aiken-y, the kind of guys who were always in church and helping people and being... he's so sweet. So he's the sweetest boy. And that's code. Sweet is evangelical code for... he's gay.
There was a line from something where somebody says, like, Well, we always thought he was a sister boy, but he was sure good to his mama.
Right. Exactly. And so these are the kind of guys who go out of their way to build up good credit by doing everything they can for the church, best in the church, being the best little boy in the world, and earning, like, bowing and scraping for the love of everyone until everyone really does love them. I mean, where else would you be able to, in a small conservative Texas town, be the most popular person in town and be a homosexual? Like, it boggles the mind in a way that this is a real story. Like, they didn't even take liberties with this story. This is like faithful to real life as
it was. Co-written by Linklater and Skip Hollandsworth, based on a Texas Monthly article that Hollandsworth wrote about the whole murder case.
Yeah.
So yeah, and like I said, the actual people from town are all in this movie talking about it.
So it's really fascinating, really funny, really like sad, and just it's great. I think it's getting some mixed kind of reviews, but
really?
Those people are wrong.
Yeah. Go see Bernie. It's a treat. Real quick, a couple. We each had a movie that we saw that the other one didn't.
Girl in Progress.
That's it. That's your whole.
Like. If Gilmore Girls were directed by Uwe Boll every week, if Uwe Boll was the showrunner of Gilmore Girls, that's this movie. Like, mother-daughter, mother wants to be daughter's best friend, not her mom, so she's... Now, obviously, in the show Gilmore Girls, she's actually a responsible mother, and everyone's... has a great time, and it's a wonderful town, and it's a wonderful life, and everything is fantastic. This movie, everything's a disaster, and everyone's unhappy, and the daughter's a jerk. Like you kind of sympathize with her, that her mom sort of neglects her a little bit, but when you start to break it down, you realize that the mom's biggest crimes are that she works two jobs so that they can have food, and that
she ate all the cereal.
And that she ate all the cereal one day. And that she dates a variety of men. Because what? Because she's a whore. I don't know. There's no real reason given why.
Well, she's sleeping with her married boss.
She's sleeping with her married boss. So what?
Oops.
Yeah. And, like, why would the daughter... Why does the daughter even know this?
Mm-hmm.
You know? But meanwhile, the daughter, to rebel, goes off and you know, concocts this plan to grow up really fast. But she does it in the meanest, like, cruelest way. And I'll say this, movie really, really lost me about a third of the way in when she, as part of her plan to have her own coming of age so that she can get away from her mom faster, mm-hmm. she actually, to facilitate a cathartic tragedy in her life, she goes to a nursing home and sort of just, like, picks a dying old lady at random and says, I'm casting you as my sick, dying grandmother. I'll call you Maud. Like, doesn't even bother, like, learning the old lady's name. For comedic effect, she's like, I'll call you Maud. And the woman doesn't speak. And I'm sitting there watching it going, that's funny. I have a mother in a nursing home who doesn't speak. And if any little piece of shit walked into that nursing home and decided they were going to turn my mother into a play toy, I would strangle that child with my bare hands. I would be guilty of murdering a minor. Like, seriously. Like, and I thought, okay, if you're meaning this to be comedy, then you don't have the chops for it. And if you want me to empathize with this teenage girl and her plight by turning her into a monster, I have no idea who made this movie, why they made this movie, who edited this movie, who produced this movie, who decided any of it was a good idea. There are actual inept moments where, like, scenes that start in the morning, finish at night, You know, and it's like Eva Mendes chasing the girl all across town. Just chasing, just running down streets. And I'm like, I'm sorry, have you been running for 17 hours?
That's how she stays so fit.
Nothing makes sense. Human beings don't behave like human beings. It is rotten, rotten, rotten. Not in the little bit of heaven way where if you were had some drunk friends over, you could really rip it up and have a good time maybe watching it. This is just dismal, every moment of it. I feel sad for anybody who's take their mom to see it on who took or is taking their mom to see it on Mother's Day, because it's rotten, a rotten movie. Eva Mendes deserves better than this. She deserves a movie where she gets to sing Pimps Don't Cry.
Absolutely. No question.
Done talking.
Okay.
I'm done for this whole show. I'm freshly angry at Girl in Progress now.
Well, just simmer down while I talk a little about Where Do We Go Now, which is, I'm not even sure what country it's from. It's in Arabic with a little bit of Russian and English thrown in. And it is about...
My understanding is that it's a Pakistani movie?
No.
No? Am I wrong about that?
Maybe. Who knows? It's a small town somewhere where there has been sectarian violence. And... so they're sort of cut off from the outside world. There's like mines and like the bridge that connects the town to everywhere else is sort of, you know, half destroyed. And so it's Muslims and it's Christians, and they live together in the town, and there's sort of an uneasy coexistence. And, you know, there's an ever-filling graveyard where all the women go out to mourn. And so the Christian women and the Muslim women kind of conspire together to do what they can to keep the men from blowing their stack. And, you know, it's everything from like, you know, one night, the town's one TV gets hooked up and everybody gathers to watch, and they're changing channels and the news is on. And when this anchor woman starts talking about clashes between Christians and Muslims somewhere else, the women start arguing with each other or with their husbands in a really loud voice so nobody can hear the TV anymore.
Right.
And then later, like, they fake a miracle, you know, and says that the Virgin is telling them they all have to, like, you know, coexist peacefully. You know, they Shanghai a troop of Ukrainian strippers and bring them to town to distract the men. They make like a batch of like hashish laden donuts and cookies to calm everybody down. So, I mean, you know, it's a funny kind of farcical Lysistrata sort of thing, you know, where like the women are you know, and the priest and the imam are also in cahoots trying to like keep everybody calm. But then like the movie kind of feels like they have to have some genuine tragedy in it. So like a really awful thing happens that of course then has to be kept hidden because it would set off all these other things. And it's a really hard juggling act to go in tone from like kooky farce with musical numbers to genuinely sad, awful thing, and then back to wacky farce again. And that's where the movie loses me. And like, it was such a cool idea, and you know, it's a bold and audacious idea, but they just get the tone wrong, and it sinks the whole film, unfortunately. So it won the Audience Award at Toronto, which is kind of a big deal because like Slumdog Millionaire and King's Speech won that award, and that became this sort of like Oscar predictor thing. This movie, obviously.
Not anymore.
Not so much. So yeah, I was, you know, kind of a letdown for me, I thought. You've already said,
like most of life.
Indeed. You've already said that your DVD picks were Pickpocket and L'Argent, and I'll just...
L'Argent.
I will say mine is Spirited Away. You've probably seen it, but if you haven't, for heaven's sake, and if you have a young girl in your life that you can show it to, all the more reason. It's gorgeous.
And we got to go, because we got to hold the mail for next week, because we have a million things.
We do have letters to read for next time. And if you would like to be in that stack of letters, you can always drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Send us any questions, comments, concerns, whatever it is. We'd love to hear from you. You can like us on Facebook at the Linoleum Knife Podcast page. You can follow us.
I love how you bullied people into liking us this week. You're like, how come you don't like us on Facebook?
I didn't.
All these people are like, okay, I'll like you.
I didn't phrase it exactly right, like that.
We'll like. Yeah, these people aren't even listening. It's like, okay, I'll like it. But get off my back.
Some people who did listen didn't know there was a page, so it accomplished something. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast, and you can check into the show on GetGlue.com. If you are a fan of the show, tell your friends, post our links places.
Yeah, we really do need that. We need more of a push. out into the world.
We're growing in a tiny way, but we'd like
grow
to
like millimeter by millimeter.
Yeah, we'd like to kick it up a notch. So yeah, post it on your various social media, on your Tumblrs and your Twitters and whatever else. And go to iTunes and leave us a nice review. That always helps. It helps people find the show.
And your flam flittlers.
Yes, and your ting tooflers. Your electrohucardio schnooks. And as always, want to thank our podcast pals, the Popcorn Mafia, the Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Blowhard, Fat Guys of the Movies, Criterion Cast, The Showbiz Sandbox, Secretly Timid, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, which had a great line this week where they said that William Atherton was the Skeet Ulrich to John Glover's Johnny Depp.
Yes, whatever that means.
Schmoes No, Film Spotting SVU, and... yeah, that is it. Thank you for joining us this week, and we'll be back next time.
You wish. Goodbye.